This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
There's a strange irony in the media. Even as some publications lay people off or shutter their windows and doors, you still have more choices than you ever had before. Where do you get your news? If it's not the old newspaper or news magazine, where is it going to come from? And what do we make of this story of drag queen story hours at public libraries? It's actually a fad. Why is that and how is it being covered? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So, first of all, happy birthday today.
You're welcome.
And then, I'm wondering, you've got one more year with Get Religion, God willing, and you have to be thinking about the, kind of the future of journalism in general and the future of religion coverage in the media. What kind of advice would you give to the consumer of news for the future of their news consumption?
Well, first of all, let's clarify what I just put up in a post at Get Religion. I agreed to edit Get Religion full time, you know, for a certain period of time, and I hit 65 today and 66 next year, which is when most Americans now retire or come close to it. I'm hoping that Get Religion doesn't go away. I'm hoping, frankly, that it evolves into something that covers a lot more subjects related to religion and media. And I'm hoping that a feature called Get Religion remains a part of that. It would certainly be a good thing to keep the like 13 million word archive, you know, together of the media criticism that the team has done all of these years, since we clicked online early in 2004, which in internet years is like an eternity. So I don't know exactly what that will be like, but I know that I probably won't be writing every day for Get Religion the way I have. I'd like to cut it back to like two or three times a week and keep doing the podcasts. So I'm not planning to vanish. It's just that we know that change is ahead. As always happens, you know, when someone who creates something and runs it steps down, you know, from that role and goes into a smaller role. So that's just a clarification there. Now back to your question. It is, of course, a huge question I get asked all the time, which was why we made that the central question of my presentation a year and a half ago at the Issues Etc. conference near St. Louis. And I have students in particular asking me this, and the simple fact of the matter is that, like in so many things in the digital age, there's a term used in media which is bundling. And bundling is when you pay one fee to be able to get content about a lot of different subjects. Let me give you some examples of well-known media bundles. The old classic weekly news magazines were perfect examples of a bundle. You subscribed to Time magazine, and you got cover stories about all kinds of different things. And then when you went inside, you saw the work of veteran, fabulous correspondents like Get Religion's own Dick Osling, who spent decades as the chief religion writer at Time. And you saw religion and entertainment and science and all kinds of subjects like that all bundled together for one price in the magazine. You couldn't subscribe pre-internet. You couldn't say, oh, I'm just interested in religion. Give me all of the Time religion stuff, and I don't want to pay for everything else. That's a bundle. Another bundle would be the cable package that was the basis of television life in the post-Big Four era, in the era after ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, whatever. And you paid, most of us do, like at the second level, you paid a certain degree of money, and you got 100 channels or so, hopefully including your favorite sports team. And the money you paid for the bundle helped all of those different channels stay open. But constitutionally speaking, in the eyes of the founding of our country, the most important bundle in American public discourse has been the local newspaper, in which you paid a fee to get a newspaper that arrived on your porch or your driveway or your mailbox. And this bundle addressed all kinds of local subjects. By paying for this one paper, you got your high school football team covered, but you also got city council covered. You got to read about a zoning dispute involving a bar 50 yards from a church, and you also got to read a funky story about the wonderful woman in your neighborhood who every year at Halloween hands out fresh cookies or something. You know what I'm saying? You got all of this community in a bundle for one price. Well, what happens to a media when people stop buying the bundle? They no longer want the bundle. They only want what they want. My own son, a couple of years, said, "Dad, what's going to happen to cartoons in the newspaper if young readers and everybody else stops reading newspapers or buying newspapers?" And I said, "Well, what do you think?" And he says, "Well, people will just put them on the internet, right? We'll all be able to read them on the internet." And I said, "And how much are you willing to pay to the cartoonists for what they put on the internet so that they can still have a life, that they can still have a house and health care and their children can go to school and whatever?" And my son sat there for a long time going, "Well, I thought everything on the internet was free." Well, I hope you can see where I'm going with this. When it comes to religion right now, I can't point anybody to one particular product. I can't even point people to newspapers that will cover religion in general the way they kind of used to, although I would say right now there are several people covering religion at the Washington Post. But these days, that means you kind of have to say, "Well, I want to pay all that money to get the Washington Post on everything else, and I kind of agree with the Washington Post approach to religion and politics and morality and culture." And the same would go for the New York Times or any other national product. So I'm giving you a long answer here, but finally, what I'm going to have to end up saying is we need to find some products we're willing to pay for, because otherwise you can't create quality new information unless someone pays for it somehow. In the meantime, what I would suggest to most people, you'll remember this is what I suggested at the conference, is that people get on Twitter, much more than Facebook, and find 10 or 12 journalists or very good commentators on journalism that you either agree with or that, even better, you don't agree with them but you respect them. And look and try to find out what those people are reading. Now, this is going to get us into some familiar names. Everyone from, say, a scholar like Robbie George of Princeton, or Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, or Rod Dreher, or Ross Douthat. But also, I would recommend that people follow someone like the gay rights activist Andrew Sullivan, who is liberal in the classical sense of the word on a lot of subjects related to religious liberty and subjects that, you know, I think our listeners would be interested in. Find about 15 people. You don't want to flood your inbox, but you want to find these people, and you want to try to find out who they're reading, what stories they're reading about, and then where they're going to get that information. Does that make sense just as a start?
So I got to ask you this. Most people would view the atomization of our news consumption. That is, I'm going to consume really only what interests me, and I only want to pay for that as an advance forward. It sounds like you are saying, no, that's not a good thing.
Well, it's certainly, from my perspective, it's tearing up local and regional newspapers across the country. Newspapers, to some degree, because of news subscribers and pushing the buttons of people in their choirs, newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times are doing pretty well. The problem is, how do you handle life at the local and regional levels? You know, those of us who care about politics, public discourse, public schools, private schools, sports, local environment, local restaurants, people who think local have been very worried about this now for 10, 15, 20 years, and it's getting much worse. At some point, people need to commit to purchasing a news product. And just instead of thinking about this as like Donald Trump and the raging fortunes of national politics, listeners should think about this at the local level and think to themselves, how am I going to find out what's going on in my community if there is no news publication that is committed to covering as much of our community life as possible? The other thing that's happening, and you and I have talked about this many times, this, I'm going to watch only the news I agree with and only listen to the points of view I agree with, that approach to media is, in my opinion, at the heart of the tensions that are pulling America apart into two countries that you see in like every national election. When you look at the map and you look at the zip codes, we increasingly live in two Americas, and that has a lot more to do with media consumption and core beliefs on moral, cultural, and social issues than it even has to do with our two political parties and Donald Trump, just to spot the obvious.
Terry, you have written recently about media coverage of drag queen story hours. Thought I'd never utter that set of words together in that order, but there you go. Drag queen story hours at public libraries. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a national trend. It's very clear that there are organizations who have kind of spotted this publicity opportunity for various causes that would be attached to drag queens or to LGBTQ issues in general. And it also is a perfect example of the kinds of pressures pulling on public institutions related to education. Now, if you know anything at all about public libraries, in your intro, you were clearly thinking of some deluded, hazy, rose-tinted vision of public libraries from your youth. Would
yes.
that be an accurate statement?
I worked at a public library when I was in high school, and in the years leading up to that, I spent a lot of time. I was a library geek. There was no doubt about it. And I seriously doubt there would have been any contemplation of drag queen story hours
yeah.
at the time.
Well, and then also, I think we've mentioned it on the air before, I am married to a public librarian, and right now my wife is a librarian to librarians. And I would say that I'm not expecting a drag queen story time in many public libraries here in the hills of Tennessee anytime soon, although Knoxville or Nashville, I could totally see this happening in a college town. Once again, in an area where you would have some intensely blue zip codes, and I mean blue in a political sense. But I think it's time for our listeners to stop and think about who uses public libraries today and what's happening to a lot of our public institutions. And I have what you might find to be a perfectly bizarre image for them to contemplate. A number of years ago, I can't remember if we've discussed it on the air before, a couple of years ago or many years ago, I went to the first ever Harry Potter Studies Symposium in Orlando, Florida. Of course, it had to be in Orlando, you know, near all the theme parks. And I was in Florida at the time visiting family, and or that even might be while I lived in Florida at West Palm Beach. Anyway, I went up to Orlando and attended this Harry Potter Studies Symposium. Now, who would you do you think would show up for a global symposium on Harry Potter studies?
Well, okay, I'm going to sound awfully naive here, but I'm thinking about a generation that were raised on the books, so probably 30-somethings in there.
Well, this was really early. Not all the books were even out yet. I mean, we only had like four of them out at the moment.
Then I would expect parents with small children.
Yeah. Now, but what kind of parents? Now, think back in your culture wars memory banks.
Well, okay, it probably would not have been typically evangelical parents with their kids, because evangelicals were a little spooked by Harry Potter, the subject matter.
Well, some of them were, but this is where things get really interesting, and I want you to think again about who uses public li- Now, you can imagine that there were pressures on public libraries early in the hotter Harry Potter era over whether or not to do Harry Potter programs. Would you, you know, like show up and there's a woman dressed as a wizard and she's reading from Harry Potter? Would the local Southern Baptist Church feel great about this?
No, not then.
But see, here's the other flip side of this. The other thing that the other people who would show up at Harry Potter symposiums are people who are very intense readers. And to my pleasure, quite frankly, and shock, I would say one of the two largest groups of people at the Harry Potter Symposium were evangelical and Catholic homeschoolers. People who had actually read the books before they got into discussions about them, and then had started reading up on the religious views in the books, which are kind of liberal Christian. One of the main speakers was a friend of mine. Well, actually, this was the first time I met him, a homeschooling ex-Marine with a degree in classical studies from the University of Chicago, John Granger, who wrote a series of books about religion in Harry Potter. And he was doing this big lecture interpreting the fact that the books are drenched in medieval Christian symbolism and all kinds of things. That's a subject for another day. But you've got this large crowd of Catholic and evangelical homeschool moms and a few of their kids. And I would say they were the second largest group of people at the Harry Potter Symposium. The largest group of people at the symposium were lesbian Wiccans, who really loved Harry Potter, even though they knew that this wasn't the witchcraft they practiced. They really liked its what they thought of its worldview and wizardry and whatever. So now you've got this convention hall full of lesbian Wiccans, or just Wiccans in general, but a lot of them, frankly, were very upfront about the fact that they were lesbians. And then you have this large army or troop of evangelical and Catholic homeschool moms. Now, picture them in the hallways and kind of coming in and out of the lectures. Now, that long image is setting up the fact that that is now your public library. There are few institutions in American public life that politically and culturally are to the left of the American Library Association. You can look this up. And a lot of that I agree with. As you know, I'm a free speech liberal. This whole thing with the Drag Queen Story Hour is essentially about free speech in public institutions. And frankly, I'm all in favor of free speech, but we'll get to in a second to how I think churches and others should respond to this. But your local public library is also used to a tremendous degree by some of the most conservative members of our communities, homeschoolers, people who are really dedicated to reading and even classical education. This is where they want to go to get their books. and to get their materials to help assist them in their homeschool or classical school education. Now, how well do you think those two crowds get along?
Well, outside the library, probably not very well.
Not very well, and inside the library, not very well. When it comes to what books should be promoted, what programs should be promoted. So now we have two aspects of Drag Queen Story Hour. First of all, the coverage of this is exactly what you would expect. What we're seeing over and over, including the post I put up today, is an entire story based totally on the viewpoints of the librarians and the activists and the readers behind Drag Queen Story Hour. Then there are the critics. Now, how do you think the critics are handled?
Well, are they represented?
Probably, in most cases, something will be taken off a website somewhere that where they can have like one paragraph saying, the critics claim on their Facebook page. In other words, we're not going to actually touch these people, interview these people, talk to these people, because they don't deserve to have a role in this debate, because we all know there really isn't a debate here. This is good. We can't even comprehend what these crazy religious folks are so worried about. Now, that's a very interesting story, but it's also an example of everything you and I have talked today about the fact that the media is having trouble trying to do coverage that appeals to people on both sides of controversial moral social issues. This is like an ink blot test for the whole world of media bias and struggles with covering religion. Meanwhile, how do you think this would go down? What happened if local churches, let's say your local Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, along with maybe a conservative Catholic church, a Baptist church, a Southern Baptist church, an African-American Pentecostal church, what if several of these decided to go to their public library and say, okay, we would like to have a weekly event celebrating Black church preaching and Bible storytelling. So we want to have Bible hour, storytelling hour, with Pastor Greg from our local church. Or maybe the Catholics decide once a week, we would like to have a reading for children on classic Christian children's literature. And we want to read from the Christian classics. And as a part of this Catholic program, we also will do religious poetry, and we will end every one of our sessions with the rosary. Or the Missouri Synod congregations all get together and approach the library and say, we would like to have every week a reading story time for the parents who have their children in alternative Christian schools of all kind, and we want to read the great texts of the Western Christian mind once a week. Okay, A, how do you think that would be received at the public library? And B, how do you think that story would be covered?
Well, I don't think it'd be very well received at the public library. And I think probably because they'd say we're a public institution and you're asking us to kind of do a soft sell on your religious principles, whatever they may be, under the guise of reading to our kids.
Precisely right. But at the same time, would you agree that that means they have to say that there are no religious, moral, or cultural overtones to Drag Queen Story Hour?
I think they would have to say that. I think
even when the story I wrote about today is about a drag queen named Antichrist. A-N-N-I-E-C-H-R-I-S-T, Antichrist, which sounds a little bit like something else.
Nonetheless, I think they would maintain, despite the name play there, that there's nothing inherently religious about having a drag queen read stories to kids.
Right. So what if instead of protesting Drag Queen Hour, you protested by reading the Chronicles of Narnia on the front steps of the library?
Are you suggesting this?
I'm just saying I think it's an interesting idea. And normally, a liberal approach to free speech is not to fight speech, but to promote more speech, more variety in speech, more different kinds of speech. In effect, I'm asking if our public libraries can still be a bundle. See what I did there? Do we in our society today have the ability to tolerate each other in supporting the creations of institutions that bundle together wide ranges of viewpoints within our communities and within our culture in the form of general interest magazines, newspapers, cable channel selections, network news shows, public libraries, and ultimately, here's the explosion that's awaiting us. At what point does this almost completely threaten the concept of public schools? This is a huge issue, and right now, it does not look like, to me, that our newspapers are capable of covering both sides of these disputes. And that's a very painful thing for me to admit. Now, I would be the first to say that there are definitely some journalists who are up to the task. There are journalists who want to do it, and in some publications they're allowed to do it. I'm talking about the broader trend. And that leads to my post today at Get Religion, in which I end by simply asking, how many of us at this point believe the press wants to handle this? Big deal, right?
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is also founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you again next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.